Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. We bring you important and interesting stories every day, and we do it in a way that makes it easy for you if English is not your first language. You will notice that we speak a little slower than normal, and we use fewer words that are easier to understand. Today, we have a special program for you. It is about journalism in the United States and a famous publication that recently made a big mistake. When future reporters are studying in journalism schools, they are often told by their teachers to make sure that they do not become part of the story. In other words, make sure that you just report what happened, but do not become involved with the people in the story. But in this case, what the reporter wrote and later found out that she was wrong became a major news story in itself. In December of last year, a well-known American magazine retracted a major story. The story reported on a sexual attack at the University of Virginia. A student, identified as Jackie, told the reporter a group of students raped her at a fraternity party in 2012. But the magazine later said the story was not true. Katie Weaver joins me to help explain what happened.
The story was called A Rape on Campus, A Brutal Assault and Struggle for Justice at UVA. Rolling Stone magazine published it in November 2015. Reporter Sabrina Rubin Erdley wrote the report. It received a lot of interest. Other magazines, newspapers, and blogs followed with more stories about sexual attacks. The media also discussed other issues related to the report, such as alcohol abuse at colleges and social pressure from student groups. Women's groups and others protested against the actions the report described. Following the Rolling Stone report, Teresa Sullivan, the president of University of Virginia, suspended all activities on campus related to fraternities and sororities. And she asked the police department to investigate the rape incident. But within a week of the report's publication, Richard Bradley, an author and an editor, raised a question. Is the Rolling Stone story true? He asked why the reporter did not interview the victim's friends or the accused rapists. On December 5th, The Washington Post raised more questions about the story. The Post said there was no party on the day of the reported sexual attack, and even Jackie's friends questioned her story.
Publications rarely retract a story. Admitting a story is false can seriously damage a publication's reputation. Rolling Stone owner Jan Winner wanted to learn what mistakes were made in reporting and publishing the story and how to avoid them in the future. So he asked experts at the Columbia Journalism Review, or CJR, to investigate. Rolling Stone's investigation, a failure that was avoidable, was released April 5th. Columbia journalism professor Sheila Coronel wrote the piece along with Steve Cole, the dean of the school's journalism department, and Derek Kravitz, a researcher at Columbia Journalism School.
The investigators' findings were simple. They wrote that the reporter, Sabrina Rubin Erdley, made one major mistake. She based her whole story on information from a single person, the woman who said she was raped. The CJR report noted that Ms. Erdley wrote about three friends of Jackie. She described the conversation the four shared on the night of the reported attack. Ms. Erdley used false names for the friends, but did not identify them as false. Ms. Erdley also failed to explain that the description of the conversation came from Jackie only. Ms. Erdley did not contact the friends to confirm the conversation or learn anything else they might offer. Ms. Erdley also never learned the identity of a single suspected attacker. However, she did partly identify the reported attackers as members of the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity. Ms. Erdley wrote that the attack took place during a party at the fraternity's house on campus. And Ms. Erdley did seek a comment from the fraternity. But the CJR report says the reporter provided the fraternity very little information about Jackie's claims or any details of the story. As a result, the fraternity was not able to provide very helpful information. The Columbia Journalism Review investigation did not blame just Sabrina Rubin Erdley for the story. It also said the editors involved in a rape on campus failed. It said the editors did not urge Ms. Erdley to seek confirmation of Jackie's story. It said they should have demanded that she get more sources. And finally, the investigators wrote that the editors should have blocked publication of the story.
Why did a good reporter make such basic mistakes? Ms. Erdley told the CJR team that she became too sensitive or sympathetic to the subject of her story. She said she believed Jackie's story. She said Jackie was unwilling to provide names and claimed to be frightened for her life. But Ms. Erdley also said she was worried Jackie would withdraw from the story if Ms. Erdley asked too much for additional information. CJR's Sheila Coronel said that concern was a major failing on Sabrina Rubin Erdley's part. Journalists have to be able to break with a subject if they cannot responsibly report on it.
Last month, police ended their investigation of the reported rape. They said they did not find any evidence of an attack at the fraternity house, nor of a party on the day claimed in the report, nor of a member described as the leader of the attack. Phi Kappa Psi fraternity says it will take legal action against Rolling Stone for what it calls reckless or irresponsible reporting. A fraternity statement also says the group worries that the whole incident might lead some rape victims to fear reporting real attacks. Like the original piece, A Rape on Campus, A Brutal Assault and Struggle for Justice at UVA, the CJR investigation has led to much public discussion. This time, the subject is journalism and the responsibility it carries. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. Thank you.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Bees play an important part in the growth of crops. About 4,000 wild bee species are native to North America. Other bee species on the continent were imported from Europe to produce honey. Bees also serve as crop pollinators. These pollinators carry material from one plant to another. This helps the plants produce seeds. Farmers became dependent on this bee activity. But for the past 40 years, the native bee population has been decreasing. Since the winter of 2006, many honeybees have disappeared. Scientists call this colony collapse disorder. VOA recently went to the town of Lockford in the Central Valley of California. Researchers there are mixing plants to try to bring back the bees. Margaret Smither Caporal is a botanist, a scientist who studies plants. She leads the Lockford Plant Materials Center. It is one of more than 24 centers around the country operated by the United States Department of Agriculture. The centers are working to rebuild and support healthy ecosystems. For the past several years, Ms. Smither Caporal has planted different kinds of flowers, grasses, and other plants. She is trying to create a combination of plants that bees will like.
On the right, I have a planting of native grasses. And then in the other field, where you can see it's green, we've planted 8 different commercial pollinator mixes.
Life is not easy for bees. They must deal with pesticides and smaller animals that live on or in them, such as bee mites. But the biggest difficulty is the destruction of areas where they live and eat. Jessica K. Crew works at the Xerces Society, a conservation group. She says growth in agriculture industries and the growth of cities have left bees too few natural areas where they seek their food, pollen, and nectar. These two plant substances make up 100% of a bee's food. So Ms. Crew says bees are totally dependent on some kinds of flowers for their survival. Ms. Crew also says humans need bees to help crops grow.
About 85% of the world's flowering plants require a pollinator, basically, in order to reproduce. In our agricultural ecosystems, about 1 in every 3 bites of food or drink that we consume requires a pollinator.
She says honeybees raised by farmers also face problems. She says farmers provide the bees with food that does not give them what they need when crops are not available. She says that damages the health of the bees. But Ms. Crew says a more serious threat to honeybees is colony collapse disorder. No one knows what causes it or how to stop it.
We know that beekeepers will go out and find their hives mysteriously empty, but they're not finding necessarily a hive full of dead bees. There's just no bees.
Ms. Cruz works with Ms. Smither Caporal to choose and plant the mix of plants at the Lockford Center. They examine whether the plants they have grown bring back native bees that can be used to provide pollination to local farms. The two women also urge farmers to put plants that bees like in areas where crops are not planted. These include equipment and vehicle storage areas and areas next to roads and fields. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more environment, science, and agriculture reports, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The early years of the 20th century were a time of movement for many black Americans. Traditionally, most blacks lived in the southeastern states. But in the 1920s, many blacks moved to cities in the north. Black Americans moved because living conditions were so poor in the rural areas of the Southeast. But many of them discovered that life was also hard in the colder northern cities. Jobs often were hard to find. Housing was poor, and whites sometimes acted violently against them. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell about the life of black Americans in the 1920s and how they helped form traditions.
The years just before and after 1920 were difficult for blacks. It was a time of racial hatred. Many whites joined the Ku Klux Klan organization. The Klan often terrorized blacks. Klan members sometimes burned fiery crosses in front of the houses of black families, and they sometimes beat and murdered blacks. The Ku Klux Klan also acted against Roman Catholics, Jews, and foreigners, but it hated blacks most of all.
The United States also suffered a series of race riots in a number of cities during this period. White and black Americans fought each other in Omaha, Philadelphia, and other cities. The worst riot was in Chicago. A swimming incident started the violence. A black boy sailing a small boat entered a part of the beach used by white swimmers. Some white persons threw stones at the boy. He fell into the water and drowned. Black citizens heard about the incident and became extremely angry. Soon, black and white mobs were fighting each other in the streets. The violence lasted for 2 weeks. 38 persons died. More than 500 were wounded. The homes of hundreds of families were burned. The violence in Chicago and other cities did not stop black Americans from moving north or west. They felt that life had to be better than in the South.
Black Americans left the South because life was hard, economic chances few, and white hatred common. But many blacks arrived in other parts of the country only to learn that life was no easier. Some blacks wrote later that they had only traded the open racism of the rural Southeast for the more secret racism of northern cities. Blacks responded to these conditions in different ways. Some blacks followed the ideas of Booker T. Washington, the popular black leader of the early 1900s. Washington believed that blacks had to educate and prepare themselves to survive in American society. He helped form a number of training schools where blacks could learn skills for better jobs, and he urged blacks to establish businesses and improve themselves without causing trouble with whites. Other blacks liked the stronger ideas of William Du Bois. Du Bois felt that blacks had to take firm actions to protest murders and other illegal actions. He published a magazine and spoke actively for new laws and policies to protect black rights. Du Bois also helped form a group that later became the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The NAACP became one of the nation's leading black rights organizations in the 20th century.
Probably the most important leader for black Americans in the 1920s did not come from the United States. He was Marcus Garvey from the Caribbean island of Jamaica. Garvey moved to New York City in 1916. He quickly began organizing groups in black areas. His message was simple. He said blacks should not trust whites. Instead, they should be proud of being black and should help each other. Garvey urged blacks to leave the United States, move to Africa, and start their own nation. Marcus Garvey organized several plans to help blacks become economically independent of whites. His biggest effort was a shipping company to trade goods among black people all over the world. Many American blacks gave small amounts of money each week to help Garvey start the shipping company. However, the idea failed. Government officials arrested Garvey for collecting the money unlawfully. They sent him to prison in 1925, and 2 years later, President Coolidge ordered Garvey out of the country. Marcus Garvey's group was the first major black organization in the United States to gain active support from a large number of people. The organization failed, but it did show the anger and lack of hope that many blacks felt about their place in American society.
Blacks also showed their feelings through writing, art, and music. The 1920s were one of the most imaginative periods in the history of American black art. Claude McKay, Langston Hughes, and County Cullen were three of the leading black poets during this time. McKay was best known for his poems of social protest. Hughes produced poems about black life that experts now say are among the greatest American poems ever written. Black writers also produced longer works. Among the leading black novelists were Jesse Fawcett, Jean Toomer, and Rudolph Fisher.
Thank you.
The 1920s also were an exciting time for black music. Black musicians playing the piano developed the ragtime style of music. Singers and musicians produced a sad, emotional style of playing that became known as the blues. And most important, music lovers began to play and enjoy a new style that was becoming known as jazz. Jazz advanced greatly as a true American kind of music in the 1920s. Musicians Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and UB Blake played in gathering places and small theaters. White musicians and music experts from universities came to listen. Soon, the music became popular among Americans of all kinds and around the world.
Blacks began to recognize in the 1920s their own deep roots in the United States. They began to see just how much black men and women already had done to help form American history and traditions. The person who did the most to help blacks understand this was black historian Carter G. Woodson. Woodson received his training at two leading universities, Harvard in Massachusetts and the Sorbonne in France. He launched a new publication, the Journal of Negro History, in which he and other experts wrote about black life and history. Historians today call Woodson the father of the scientific study of black history.
The 1920s also were a period in which a number of blacks experimented with new political ideas and parties. The difficult social conditions of the period led many blacks to search for new political solutions. Two leftist parties, the Socialists and the Communists, urged blacks to leave the traditional political system and work for more extreme change. Two leading black socialists, Chandler Owen and A. Philip Randolph, urged blacks to support socialist candidates. However, they gained little popular support from blacks. Communists also tried to organize black workers, but generally, black voters showed little interest in communist ideas. The most important change in black political thinking during the 1920s came within the traditional two-party system itself. Blacks usually had voted for Republicans since the days of Abraham Lincoln. But the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s caused many blacks to become Democrats. By 1932, blacks would vote by a large majority for the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Roosevelt, and blacks continue to be a major force in the Democratic Party.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. The narrators were Kay Gallant and